Welcome to Autopilot, a podcast where we discuss the past, present, and future of AI and automation.
From Atlanta, Fulton County, Passions.
It's one small step for man.
We explore how AI is creating and disrupting large industries in conversations with top founders, investors, and historians. I'm your host, Will Summerlin. Let's dive in. All right, Jordan, thanks for joining me for the Autopilot podcast. Before we get into the nuances of legal workflows and where there's room for automation, maybe we could just start with you. Can you share your background and the founding story of Responsive?
Yeah, of course. And thanks, Will, for having me on. So I'm Jordan Domash. I'm the CEO and founder of Responsive. Responsive is a legal research platform that leverages AI to help in-house attorneys answer legal questions. Just a quick intro. So myself and my background, I started my career in consulting at one of the big management consulting firms. I did that for a few years and ended up joining Relativity. Relativity is one of the big legal tech success stories over the past 10, 20 years. I was at Relativity for 8 years. And what Relativity does is e-discovery. And e-discovery is basically the phase in litigation where you understand what actually happened. What's the electronic evidence? How do you sift through the tens of millions or hundreds of millions of emails or chats relevant in a litigation? And we've been using AI and e-discovery for a long time, for more than a decade. And so yes, AI is all the buzz today, but my career has basically been building products that leverage AI for attorneys and how do you actually get them to use this type of technology. And, you know, was at Relativity for 8 years, launched a business there, and then eventually ended up leaving to launch Responsive last year.
Was Relativity selling into law firms or companies? What was like the end customer base like?
Yeah, so Relativity sold to all segments. So it sold to corporations, government agencies, law firms, and then also large service providers, consulting firms. And I think most people probably didn't realize that the bulk of the business was actually to consulting firms, to Deloitte and EY and Epic and Consilio, because this is such a e-discovery is such a complex technical process that even the big law firms often needed help gathering all the data. So the biggest customer segment was service providers, consulting firms, but then law firms were kind of number two. But you know, all segments have discovery challenges.
That's interesting. I would not have guessed Deloitte over law firms. In terms of like the sort of early machine learning applications within e-discovery, like what was, you know, if you go back 10, 15 years, like how were you guys using AI and what was it like then? And how has it sort of evolved over the last 15 years?
Yeah, so it was more traditional machine learning models. And there's a couple of different workflows. I think the one that's most well known is something that's called technology assisted review or predictive coding. And that's really a machine learning model, like a categorization model, where you take an individual document. So a document could be an email or a chat or a Slack message or a phone call or a text message. And you're basically taking millions of them. And for every document, you're making a decision. Is this relevant to the litigation or the investigation? Or is this not? And it's a binary decision, a yes, no decision. And so what you do is you basically train, you label 1,000 documents or 10,000 documents, yes, no, most of them being no. And then you recategorize every other document with a likelihood of it being relevant or responsive to the litigation. And so that's the most well-known workflow, but there's a lot of other AI related workflows integrated into the platform. So if you find one relevant document, you can click a button to say, find more that are conceptually similar to this. So you can kind of expand from one relevant document to everything that kind of tells the story around it. Or you can highlight a paragraph and say, find more similar to this. And there's lots of ways to basically find similar phrases or documents or words that aren't exactly the same. They aren't exact synonyms, but they're conceptually similar that allow you in a investigatory workflow to kind of expand beyond the one that you're looking at. And this has been in, you know, discovery tools for more than a decade.
But before that technology was in place, was it basically just like associates just filtering through or paralegals filtering through docs, just like trying to decide whether or not they were relevant?
Yes. And to be honest, it's still, as long as AI has been in the discovery world, the vast majority of work is still someone physically looking at a document and saying, this is relevant, this is not relevant. It could be, you know, there's contract attorneys, there's a whole set of different players. There's outsourced review shops that will use offshore labor to do that in a cheaper way. So there's lots of ways folks get around trying to do this as cheaply as possible. But there is a lot of physical human hours spent reading documents in general to determine if they're relevant or not. So like my whole takeaway is, you know, it's not always having the best AI. Like you need to actually get attorneys to use it. It needs to be practical. It needs to be something they can trust. It needs to be defensible. It's more than just the AI. It takes a lot for the industry to actually adopt the technology.
On the e-discovery side, like it seems like an obvious use case, right? Like if you could take something that takes, you know, 100,000 human labor hours and like do your software to do that instead, like probably a very high ROI. What have been like the reasons why companies have been hesitant to adopt it?
Yeah, and so a lot of people have adopted it, right? It's a massive multi-billion dollar industry. So I don't want to say that AI like hasn't been adopted. It's seen pretty massive adoption if you think of like the, you know, millions of gigabytes that have gone through these types of tools, but you'd be surprised it's not, you know, a majority of the content is not being reviewed using this artificial intelligence. I would say a couple of reasons why. One is there's natural skepticism. Just like people are a bit nervous if the technology is going to be perfect and there's a very high bar for accuracy. I think two is explainability matters a lot, knowing why it's very easy to explain why a keyword hit. It's much harder to explain why a machine learning algorithm didn't score it higher. There's really a lot of reasons. And also at the end of the day, every matter is unique. Right. So it's people haven't necessarily built or trained models across matters. Every investigation or litigation or lawsuit is a little bit bespoke. And so there's a process of training a model specific to the, at least historically, there had been training a model specific to the matter, which even if you're using machine learning, like you have to train that model and then validate it at the end. So even if you fully adopted the technology, there's still a pretty manual process on either end.
Sure, that makes total sense. So we talked about relativity and e-discovery. If we zoom out for a second and think about like the different types of legal work, maybe you can just give us like a topographical map of the different types of legal work and sort of inside lawyers versus external counsel.
Yeah, I mean, it's massive. I think often folks in technology think of legal as one big in an industry, but in reality, there's a lot of different workflows, a lot of different tools, and a lot of different processes that need to happen within a larger corporation. So what I'm going to do is vastly oversimplify the universe here. And it's pretty different depending if you're JP Morgan or one of the largest banks, or you're a small startup, the universe is going to be pretty different. But generally, the type of work often aligns to practice areas, which is how like a law firm would organize. So one big bucket is litigation. And that's often where a lot of the money and effort gets spent. Litigation is both, you know, the threat of litigation, preparing for potential litigation, the discovery process of actually uncovering the truth behind what happened, and then actually going to court and battling out the potential litigation. So that's one bucket. Another pretty large bucket, which is pretty industry dependent, would be compliance or the regulatory function, making sure that you are complying with the ever-changing jurisdictional specific regulations that might be relevant to your organization. And each of these functions that I'm talking about have a whole set of workflows underneath them. But moving beyond compliance regulation, litigation, you've got employment. You think about every time you onboard a new employee, you think about paying payments, wages, benefits, performance. Employment is generally state specific in the US, the types of laws that you need to manage. So in this new world where we're hiring folks remotely, you've got employees in every different jurisdiction. It's a process to onboard a new state and stay compliant with the regulations and laws in that specific jurisdiction. And then obviously commercial is a big one, both selling whatever product you're selling and buying whatever product you're buying. That can be a high effort process to negotiate every specific agreement. And then there's countless other, you know, privacy products. It can go on and on. Corporate and M&A and managing your corporate governance. Each of those are often separate skill sets and experiences that attorneys will come into the organization with.
I've just paid a legal bill, so this is top of mind. I was researching this morning, and legal spend in the U.S. has increased on average 30% year over year for companies. What's driving? I mean, 30% increase year over year is a huge number. So what's driving that? Is it like the remote work thing and all the complexity around HR? Is it something else?
Yeah, and I haven't necessarily. Maybe I should be tracking that higher level statistic a bit closer. And so I think this would be a bit of a guess. I think, first of all, organizations are getting more complex. They're growing in size. They are operating in more and more jurisdictions. And I think as it becomes easier, you know, as a business to scale globally, the downstream legal implications of that become much more complex. So businesses are just more complicated. And I think it depends on the practice area that you're talking about. With litigation in particular, there's just way more data than ever before. If you go back, you know, 30 years, there's not necessarily a record of everything that you said that could be relevant in a litigation. Today, it's not just email. Every text message you send is stored on your phone. Every document you create is stored on your computer. So there's just way more content. And then when you think of some of these other practice areas, employment, privacy, there's so many state-specific laws that are popping up every day. Our laws are changing pretty frequently, and it's a lot of effort to stay on top of basically the law and what you need to be compliant with. And so it's just it's a fairly complex process now.
Yeah, the permanent digital footprint is in some ways kind of terrifying. This was like really drilled into us at ARC, right? We were a big public market investor and had a lot of compliance. And it was like every text you send is going to be documented. You know, all your social media accounts are going to be tracked, and like that's all in a big repository somewhere. So be very careful about what you say and who you say it to.
Yeah, I mean, so working for a discovery company, like basically that's what happened in every investigation or lawsuit. If someone said something pretty stupid and they kept it, they said it in writing and it doesn't go away. That's something that you learn. Specifically regulated financial orgs, FINRA and the SEC actually require regulated financial institutions to store every communication that was sent or received, and they're obligated to have a record of that. And you can be fined if you delete something. And so there's a whole other set of constraints if you're a financial institution and knowing like what records need to be saved. That's also different depending on if you're buy side, sell side, different jurisdictions. And it's like there's teams structured around how do I, you know, appropriately retain my content in case it ever becomes relevant in a lawsuit.
Yeah, it's it increases the surface area of data to search, but also slightly terrifying as someone whose data could be searched. You know, shifting to responsive a little bit, maybe you can break down like how companies sort of spend legal budgets on internal lawyers versus external law firms. And like on the surface, not being an expert, when I think of lawyers, I think they work in a law firm, but that's not always the case. And so curious how you sort of see the world break down between internal legal teams and external law firms.
So if you think of, you know, I'm a corporation, more spend is often, you have a legal budget, more spend is being allocated often to outside counsel than your internal function. And it kind of is practice area dependent what you're doing in-house versus what you're doing, what you're bringing in outside counsel for. If you're negotiating standard agreements, that's often done internally, especially once you're at a certain scale, like it's just repetitive. You're going to be the expert in your own agreement. You know your internal playbooks around what's allowed versus litigation. litigation is a little bit less frequent. It's high risk. It's high impact. It's often the expertise you need is specific to the type of litigation. And so you're often bringing, and there's a whole spectrum and range of what you're engaging outside counsel on and what you're doing in-house, depending on the practice area. But if I'm a general counsel and I'm thinking of my scope of work, my legal risk and my budget, I'm usually thinking of both my outside counsel work and spend and my internal spend. And so it's often one portfolio, and you have a choice of what you keep in-house and what you bring in outside counsel for. And outside counsel is expensive. I mean, it's $1,000 an hour, it's $1,500 an hour. You know, partners could be $2,000 an hour. And those bills add up pretty quick, because you're not often, it's not just a 5-minute phone call. It's often, you know, days of work to uncover the answer behind a specific risk. And so there's a big cost center associated with outside counsel.
Yeah. And every email they send is 30 minutes and $800 somehow. I'm curious, on the internal side, and this is kind of getting into responsive, you guys focus primarily on those internal legal teams. What problem are you trying to solve with responsive?
Yeah. And so the problem that we're trying to solve with responsive is understanding what is the law is complicated. There's a lot of different source materials that you need to pull from to actually answer any question. So whether it's an employment question, privacy, commercial, product, compliance, regulatory, there's not just a database that you can go look at. Because yes, there's a database of laws, statutes, or regulations, but those are jurisdiction specific. So every state has their different set of laws and regulations, and then federally, it's a whole different set. There's cases that interpret statutes. There is regulatory guidance. So regulators will issue guidance around a specific topic. And then the law is changing. And so actually answering basic questions can be quite challenging. And for in-house teams, again, it really differs depending on the type of organization. But if you're, you know, a small 5-person legal team, you might have someone who's your employment attorney, and they'll be an expert on questions in your specific headquarter jurisdiction, right? In Illinois, relativity, you know, based in Illinois, a lot of the employees are in Illinois. You might know those answers off the top of your head, but once you have employees in 30 states, you don't have expertise in Florida or California or New York, and the law might be different for each of those specific jurisdictions. And so the problem that we are trying to solve is enabling access to information to allow in-house legal teams to make smart decisions quickly and at a low cost themselves, and only bring in outside counsel when they truly need the expertise of outside counsel or some deep domain knowledge that they don't have, not just because they have access to information to make a decision.
That makes sense. And maybe we can talk through like a specific example. Say that, you know, I'm an internal lawyer at a company, and we just hired an employee in Alaska, and I have some question about employment law in Alaska. What would my life look like without responsive? How would I go about solving that problem or that question? And then what does it look like today if I have responsive?
Yeah. And so maybe you're researching like the timing of payments of this employee. And if you think about it, you have a new employee in Alaska, you got to think about, you know, can we have a non-compete? That's part of our standard agreement. How do we have to pay them? Is like, there's a whole set of everything about how you engage with an employee could be different. And so you'll start with a series of questions or a couple of questions. And then you really have two options today. You either say, I'm going to do it myself and go use Google and find some random guide. And if you're working, you know, maybe if you're targeting New York or California, some law firm might have published a guide that gives you the basics, and that could be a good starting point. But it'll probably be a lot tougher in Alaska. There's not, you know, the largest law firms in the world aren't often writing up analyses of hiring employees in Alaska, or if they do, it'll be very general and not specific to your organization. So you do that, or you basically call outside counsel and say, tell me what I need to do. And they'll have this whole write-up, this whole guide, it'll be specific to you. And you could totally imagine the billable hours churning up. And so there's not really anything great in between those two ends of the spectrum.
And so and going to Responsive, like, how does Responsive fill that gap? What would my life look like if I could pull up Responsive and use you guys to answer that question?
Yeah. So the first step is you ask the question and we retrieve the most relevant information. So we'll say, here's the two or three statutes that are necessary to answer the question. Here are the few regulations that will help answer the question. Here are cases relevant to your specific fact pattern, your specific context that have interpreted how courts have interpreted that law as applied to the situation you're trying to apply it to. Then we'll also identify analysis. So if there is a law firm blog post on the topic, we'll identify that, or a law review article or some other analysis that's publicly available from a credible source. And so we're taking, we're identifying all of the most relevant source material. Then we will be synthesizing that information and saying, here's your answer. And our that answer will cite back to the source material. It will say, these sentences came from this source. This sentence came from this quote in the statute. So we know attorneys, they're going to be skeptical. They're not going to believe the AI out of the box. We make it as easy to verify the answer as possible. And then once you have the answer, if I'm an in-house attorney, like, my goal isn't always just to write a memo. I'm doing something else. Maybe I'm drafting a employment agreement for this new employee in Alaska. And so we can basically convert the answer into enforceable contract language that abides with the law, or create a policy that aligns with what we just researched. And so supporting the customer through the end-to-end process, and then having a record of how that analysis was conducted. We ran this search, we reviewed this source information, we made this decision based on this information, and you have that in your repository should you need to reference it 6 months later when some other issue pops up. So supporting the life cycle of a research task through the product.
So if I go into ChatGPT or Perplexity and ask them the same question, like, how are the results going to differ, and why is Responsive's result much more useful than, say, ChatGPT or Perplexity?
Yeah, and we could probably talk about those a bit differently. I think with ChatGPT, there's no source material. And I think with Perplexity, there is source material, but it's like the open web. It's general content. It's not going to be highly curated legal specific content. And that's where it starts. So it starts with having this repository of credible information, your cases, your statutes, the legal analysis, the regulatory guidance. So we have this base of credible content, and then we actually deeply understand that content. So statutes are complex, they're structured, they reference each other, there's a definition page. And so actually understanding that specific type of content is something that we have deep expertise in. And then training the response to be specific to what the legal users are expecting. If you think of Perplexity or ChatGPT, they've been highly tuned and highly trained to generate short form answers. Usually I want something concise. If I'm an attorney though, I want to know every exception, everything I should be concerned about. I want, and I'm used to, reading long form content. And so the output is going to be more in depth, more comprehensive, and cite back to the source information. It's just a few examples.
Yeah. And I would imagine this is like a pretty high stakes, you know, question and answer, right? Like, if you screw up employment law or, you know, securities law or really any legal issue, like, you know, the impact of doing that incorrectly would be quite expensive. And I would assume that, like, you know, ChatGPT and Perplexity are, this is a narrow use case. They're focused more horizontally, to your point, on sort of short form answers. I'm curious, how much of that is like a data asset? Like, do you guys have a proprietary data advantage specific to this category? And how do you think that's going to evolve over time?
Yeah, so we have one, and it's something that we're building over time. But when I think of like a data advantage, I think about it in two ways. There's access to the content itself, right? Like, access to the source information. And then there's how you understand that source information, which is done through annotations, labeling, truth set. So there's a whole bunch of things that we're doing. And I would say today, the value that we're adding, and we're curating a whole bunch of public content, it's available, it's out there, it's universal in nature. The value that we're adding first is really on the curation. Out of the millions of laws, which is the one law that's relevant to this particular question? The scoring algorithm to actually understand the answer that we generated, how does it compare to a truth set? And so a lot of the data advantage that we're generating is a lot more on the like that side of the house versus just having access to the case itself, if that makes sense.
Makes total sense. And if you sort of lift up the hood here, what's powering that? Are you guys building on top of GPT-4? Are you building proprietary models? How do you think about sort of the AI infrastructure behind this?
Yeah, so it's all of the above. We are building the source ranking system ourselves. So identifying, going from the list of 10 million, tens of millions of pieces of content to the 10 that are going to be relevant for the specific question, we're owning the sifting through that database of content. We're using OpenAI models for the synthesis and summarization, although that's something that we're exploring like a number of different models to serve different pieces of that pipeline. And it's something that we are also like fine tuning those models, so they're not necessarily GPT-4 out of the box. And then we have a validation process at the end, which is something that we own. And so it's kind of a combination of all different kinds of tools. We're not necessarily saying, hey, we need to go build a foundation model just to have one. We'd rather focus our energy on specific components where we believe we can add differentiated value, and then combining that into an overall workflow that does use some out-of-the-box tools as well.
Can you double-click on the verification process? That seems like an important step, especially if you're spitting out answers that could have a $50 million outcome, whether it's correct or incorrect.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of pieces to that. I would say like probably the easiest example to explain is hallucinations in legal have come up in the news a lot. I think there's just another couple of attorneys that were sanctioned because they wrote a brief to a court that just listed, referenced a bunch of cases that didn't exist. And they're like, hey, these 10 cases prove my point. And the judge was like, I can't find those. And then there's some harsh penalties associated with that. It's not something you want to happen to your company and your organization. And so part of the verification process is identifying known patterns. This is what a case looks like in a body of text. This is what a statute looks like in a body of text, and ensuring that none of them are made up, even if you are using generative AI, GPT-4, OpenAI's products, other tools, is how do you get really, really good at the verification process to ensure A, nothing is made up, and B, you're actually referencing that specific content. That's just one example of like the type of verification we've been investing in.
And I would imagine like if the like we talked about earlier, like the consequences here are pretty high stakes. And if you're selling to a buyer, I would imagine like one of the first things they dig into is like the quality of answers and the risk of hallucination. So when you're talking to a buyer and that comes up, like how do you sort of navigate your way around those fears, or how do you sort of get them comfortable with using AI in such a high stakes environment?
Yeah. So first of all, Ray, I've been building these types of products and working with attorneys for a long time. Even if the technology was perfect, they're going to be skeptical. And so you need to go into designing the product, assuming that it's a low trust environment, and you need to prove yourselves before they'll just accept the technology out of the box. And so what we've done is we've built little steps into the product that build trust and assume the customer is going to want to verify it themselves, especially a new customer that hasn't used the product before or has seen a hallucination in ChatGPT. And so basically what we do is next to every sentence our answer generates, we pull an exact quote from the source material that backs it up. So you can go click on every major point and just show the user, hey, here's what backs it up. And so it's less like the education, the trust building is done in the product, assuming they're going to want to verify it. And we make the verification as easy as possible, where it's from a trusted source that they view as credible, not from the general open web.
That makes total sense. Do you think this is going to be an industry where like there's a standard, like you guys become the standard. Seems like in other industries, like in identity for a while, like Okta was like the standard. And even though they had several breaches, if you're a CISO and you bought Okta, you could go to your board or your CEO and be like, well, it's Okta. Like they messed up, but like everybody else has Okta. This is true with like IBM, right? If you don't get fired for buying IBM. Curious if you guys get to a scale or if you think that's how this market's going to play out where a lawyer can use you guys and like, I assume you're not going to mess up, but if there was a situation where there's an error, they could be like, well, it's responsive. Everybody uses responsive. Do you think that's how this market's going to play out, or do you think it's going to be more competitive and fragmented?
Yeah, I mean, so yes and no. I would say focusing on like the problem that we're solving, legal research for in-house teams, I do think that there's elements of winner-take-all environment and like speed to scale matters. It'll take time to build that type of credibility. And I could totally see the market starting with high volume, lower risk questions, right? You're not going to completely replace going to outside counsel on bet the company litigation in day one. But there's a ton of spend and work that is something that you don't go to outside counsel for their expertise. You go to it just because you need an answer quickly. And so you kind of think of like the spectrum of work where we become the dominant go-to source. It starts as a portion of the overall spectrum of work. And eventually, as we build credibility over time, you start handling the riskiest products because you've proven yourself on everything else. And so I do see that being the journey over time. The only like hesitation I have to saying definitively yes is I think what we're solving is not necessarily the only legal workflow. Like we're not building the automated redlining solution. We're not building a e-discovery product. And so I think you play this out 5 or 10 years, I think there will be, you know, Relativity is the dominant e-discovery platform. It looks like Ironclad is kind of the dominant emerging contracting platform. You kind of will see a version of that that's AI native for a lot of these specific sub-legal verticals. And so there could be several within legal, but each being the large dominant platform in that specific vertical.
Are there like, is there like a going back to data advantages, do you think there's like a data advantage component that will sort of further drive that winner take most outcome?
Yeah, definitely. So I definitely think that like understanding the language of a request and being able to identify the like the most important content, I think is how old, like it's a very, very hard problem. And it is not necessarily won by the same general training of a, you know, GPT-4 large foundational model. And like an example of that is, and in kind of, we could talk about like traditional RAG approaches, retrieval augmented generation. Like what do? They take a large piece of content, they break it up into smaller chunks, you feed it to an engine and it has, you tell the engine to make a decision. The problem is if you take a statute could be very long. Section one will say you're allowed to do XYZ. Section 1B will say, oh, there's an exception. There's section 1C that's an exception to the exception pending some other law that's, you know, a completely different section. And so like using traditional approaches that like break up this massive body of text into smaller fragments that you go analyze independently, it doesn't really work in this context. And so there's a lot of data labeling feedback loops that are going to have to be created to effectively answer this question.
That makes sense. If we shift a little bit to like the go-to-market strategy and sort of the incentives of buyers, who do you guys typically sell to at a company? And what is their incentive structure? Are they trying to save money? Or are they trying to increase the quality of work that's coming out of their legal department? It'd be great if you could walk through that.
Yeah. So we're often primarily selling to the general counsel and the general counsel's function. Sometimes we'll be working with a solo GC that's responsible for everything. Their head's underwater. They need help because maybe they're an expert in, you know, they're an expert in M&A, but now they have to do privacy law and they just need help. And so that could be a solo GC all the way up to, you know, a large regulated financial institution. We'll have an employment team, a regulatory team, a privacy team, compliance team, so all these different functions. So often rolling up to GC, your chief compliance officer, those are the functions that we're most commonly selling to. And I would say like cost is a big factor. Legal is viewed as a cost center, but it's not the only factor, right? Like they wouldn't say, hey, we're going to cut half our outside counsel budget and get way worse outcomes. So there's a real like risk factor here to the value that you're creating. And so for us, there's a couple of considerations. A, you can cut costs. That's super important, but not exclusively the only thing. Two, you can get much faster answers. So if you're doing the work yourself, you can get answers that doesn't take a full day of research. Or if you're going to outside counsel, they might take a week to get back to you. And so if you're able to do the research yourself, something that you couldn't do previously because you didn't have access to information, and you can get a 95% answer in an hour, you're now actually getting much faster information and enables you to make decisions faster. And so there's a lot of considerations at play beyond just the cost factor, but all of this is being measured against still having great, consistent legal advice to the business.
Have you guys measured the ROI? Like if I am a GC at a company and I use Responsive to answer that Alaska HR question, how much am I saving using your product versus like calling up my lawyer and having them go dig down some rabbit hole to write a report?
Yeah, so we need to work on having consistent customer-driven measurements. So we don't have perfect metrics, but we just did in the last few days, I just had two customer check-ins, and both of them said that there was significant outside counsel spend saving. And we haven't necessarily quantified it at scale, but there were significant numbers of questions that they previously would have gone to outside counsel for that they aren't anymore, alongside a number of the benefits that we're saving. And so we don't have the exact magnitude yet, but that's something we're working on quantifying.
I would imagine if I go to a lawyer with a question, and I know, like I said, I just paid a legal bill and went through the invoice, and it seems like every time there's a question, it's like at least a $5,000 answer. Is that reasonable, or am I just getting screwed?
I would say that's very common, and I think it depends on the specific organization, firm that you're going to, your level of expertise. If I experienced general counsels that are attorneys themselves, sometimes have the ability to go pick up the phone, say, hey, I want this quick answer. Like, let me know if I'm on the right track. And so it's not always necessarily a 3-hour conversation, but I would say it often is. And with the way the economic model for large law firms are structured, right, they're paid by the billable hour, and that hour is pretty expensive. And so especially, we're super focused on in-house teams who don't have that constraint. Like they just want the right answer. They want to, there's no like economic disincentive to how you structure the work. They just want something done as fast as possible.
It seems like there's sort of an incentive structure within the law firms that would almost prevent them from adopting AI and technologies that make them more efficient. Do you think that's true? Or do you think it's sort of a competitive forcing function where, if part of them adopt it, then they all have to adopt it?
So first of all, I think attorneys law firms want to do the right thing. Like I actually really do believe they have their clients' best interests at heart. And I think if there's technology that's available, like they're going to do their best to use it. And so like at their core, they really do have their best interests at heart. But I do think when you're making decisions on technology, like in the back of your mind, even without really thinking about it critically, like there are some reasons that you're going to naturally be slow down in the adoption of that technology. I don't think they're necessarily going to say, hey, this will make us more efficient. We're not going to do that. Like I really do think outside firms have their clients' best interests at heart. But if you're at the largest law firms, there's a lot of signaling that's involved, right? You're charging crazy rates. You want your customers to believe that they're using the best tools. And so we're often seeing signaling by a few early adopters that and I'm specifically speaking about like the large law firms and a set of other, you know, use cases, like they're going to signal, hey, we have this amazing technology. And that is often a core reason why they are adopting something new. Yes, it's going to be great and add real value to their business, but it's also signaling to your clients, like you should be paying these crazy rates because we have the best tools alongside that. And I think it's much easier to get a set of early adopters than it is to shift the core majority of the market, which will have a different set of buying criteria. So I'm not sure if I directly answered your question, but there's like a lot of factors that go into technology adoption at yeah, these larger firms.
Yeah, they want to do the right thing, but like in the back of their head, there's also an incentive structure that maybe makes doing the right thing at odds with what's going to actually generate revenue. If we shift a little bit just to the AI landscape broadly, I have a thesis that vertically focused AI companies like Responsive will have an advantage over more horizontal players for a variety of reasons. Do you think that's true? Or do you think like the horizontal players like the ChatGPTs of the world will end up eating a lot of these vertical use cases?
I think there's definitely room for both. And I think, you know, I don't think ChatGPT's use case is going away. I think it's going to increase and the world will get really good at understanding what ChatGPT is good at. And I think what ChatGPT is good at is probably going to expand. And so like, there's a lot of room, like I use ChatGPT all the time for a ton of different activities. And I think there's a big room for horizontal applications, but it's pretty clear what ChatGPT is not designed for. Like OpenAI has picked a certain set of use cases that they're really focused on. I mean, they're clearly focused on developer work, coding, programming. Like, yes, it's a general platform, but as they're refining the model, like it's pretty clear that they care about programming, you know, related workflows. Legal is very different. And I think there's a set of other vertical use cases that either have a different type of data, the data has a different structure, and the out-of-the-box training coupled with the OpenAI workflow, like it's not going to be perfect for that use case. And there is a real opportunity for large vertical players, especially in vertical markets that OpenAI is not prioritizing. And so we fall into that bucket. And when we're designing, when we're choosing our focus area, like we're actively avoiding horizontal plays. Like if there's something that's pretty generalist, like we're just not going to be great at it. We're not going to create enough of an advantage over over OpenAI. And so we're prioritizing workflows that have true workflows that you need to build around generative AI, a different type of training, different type of source data. I think there's a big opportunity for both. And I don't think there's going to be, like Perplexity is an example of an organization that's doing great. They've identified, you know, a horizontal workflow that is scalable and has potential. Like it's hard to build horizontal companies because you have to like, what's the value that you can create over OpenAI? And so I do believe that it's probably a bit harder to create separate horizontal tools. There's more opportunities for emerging startups to pick vertical plays in particular.
Yeah, and it seems like vertical plays where the consequences are high is really where it's most obvious that you should have, you know, a vertical solution versus a horizontal solution. Like if I ask ChatGPT, you know, a generic answer about, you know, some history of movies, like it doesn't really matter if it gets it right or wrong. But if I ask it like, you know, whether I can do XYZ under securities law, like it really matters that it's right. And so it seems like that's another sort of axis which to judge vertical versus horizontal.
If the risk is high, it is one indicator. I think the separate thing is, right, you that one question you might go pay $5,000 for. And so there's also the cost alternative. There's budget, there's room to play to actually generate the right answer. And you don't have to, when you think of like the number of tokens of content you might have to analyze, the multiple iterations you might have to go through, there's both a time and a cost allocation that allows you to invest in the right workflow and a different type of process or content or data that you need to analyze. I think those are different indicators for the opportunity for a unique vertical player.
Yep, 100% agree. Maybe we can shift to like building responsive a little bit. You guys raised a seed round from Greylock, and it sounds like some of the team from Relativity, which is awesome. As you kind of go about building the company and you reflect back on kind of day one to where you are today, still relatively early in the journey, but like if you could go back and give yourself one piece of advice, given what you've learned in this experience, what would you tell yourself?
That's a great question. I feel like we're learning and making decisions every day. And, you know, I think a part of the benefit that I have is like, I built a business at Relativity. It was AI enabled. It was more selling to compliance teams. But like I just went through this whole journey and we went through this whole process over 5 years where I took a lot of learnings from that, where we went in pretty focused on a specific problem. And we went in pretty focused on a specific use case right away. I'd say like a few learnings in the responsive journey. Like this is our first time going through the fundraising process. You know, me as an entrepreneur, and so I have a ton of learnings of like how to go through a fundraising process. I think like the few learnings are: one, pretty small market, everyone's connected. Two, you want to create a sense of exclusivity, urgency, and so I probably would have a bit more structure. Like we got an amazing outcome, an outcome that we're super happy with, and exactly what we wanted. But I think the way we went about it, we could have done with a bit more structure, which was something that I'd never gone through something before like that. I'd say the second thing is I'm very conscious that we are selling to a very risk-averse audience. And so we were very staged in how we engaged attorneys with our product. And I think naturally all entrepreneurs are like that. And you know, the guidance is you always want to move quickly, you want to launch stuff, get stuff out and break. And so we were a bit more conservative given the domain that we are playing in, where we really wanted to get it right. But I'd say in hindsight, like the quality of our models pretty early on were good, and we probably could have been even more aggressive in going to market. But at the same time, like it's hard to know the alternative, right? Like you don't want to be in the news making up some fake case. So the other piece is just moving a bit more quickly in the public facing component of our business.
If you could go one chapter back into starting it at Relativity and the lessons you learned building that business up, what advice would you have given yourself then when you were just starting to sell into the legal industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, so the business at Relativity that I was building was leveraging the Relativity platform. So Relativity is a platform almost like a Salesforce. It's got objects and fields and choices. And we were taking the platform and building it for a different customer base. We're selling to more like compliance teams than true litigation. And so like a few learnings in that is we underestimated the amount of effort it would take to shift that core product to this new audience. And even if the workflow is pretty similar and the actual behaviors are pretty similar, it has to be positioned differently. It has to be branded differently. And then there's a whole set of like the last mile, the last 10% or last 20% is actually pretty hard to get right. And I would say it took us a year or two to understand the value and hyper positioning a product to a specific customer base. And so even if they would look at the product at the demo and it would do exactly what they wanted it to do, because it was positioned more to a litigation attorney as opposed to a compliance professional, they'd be like, oh, but it looks like more of an e-discovery tool. And so it took us probably a couple, we were saying, well, like we can do everything that you know you were expecting, but because it didn't look like something they were expecting or it wasn't necessarily positioned in the way they were expecting, it didn't have the same wow factor as it could have. And so leads to here, like what we're doing at Responsive, research is research, right? Like legal research is legal research, but there's real value in having a core focus and an audience. And if you just simplify this process that we're going through, understanding what is the law to that, you would try and be everything to everyone. And we didn't do that here. Instead, we went to the market and we're like, yes, legal research is legal research, but we have a fundamental belief that in-house attorneys, they do something different. And you have to go one, two, three layers deep into their actual workflow to truly understand how their process is different from a from an outside attorney. And so we almost just went into it. We knew it was different more than we knew the exact features we needed to build over the next 2 years to truly amplify those differences into a product. And that was something that we were really thoughtful about. Like, what's the underserved customer base that doesn't have a tool designed for them was a core part of our thinking as we launched this product.
Go narrow and win. And that's the classic startup advice, focus, focus, focus. That's great. And we're coming to an end here. If I'm a general counsel sitting out there listening to this, how can I follow you, get in touch with you?
Yeah. So shoot me an email, jordan@responsive.ai. Go to our website, responsive.ai, or look us up on LinkedIn. I'm happy to meet amazing engineers, business development, sales folks. Like, we're hiring across the board. And so super interested in connecting with amazing technologists, then also customers, attorneys who want to get a demo of the product. Happy to show you what we're building.
That's awesome. Well, Jordan, thanks for joining us.
And yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Autopilot Podcast. If you're using AI to create or disrupt a large industry, I would love to learn more about your story. Drop me a line on Twitter or go to our website, apv.vc. If you want to support the show, the best ways are to leave a review wherever you're listening and subscribe. The Autopilot Podcast is part of Turpentine, the podcast network behind Moment of Zen, Turpentine VC, Age of Miracles, and more shows for experts by experts in tech.